right? So there's the place where kind of the two strains, right, the kind of hard Wilsonian and Jacksonian strain, you know, do intersect really, really well, right? And that also has become, you know, extremely totemic, I think, in the mainstream Republican Party is America's relationship with Israel.
Right.
Right. And, you know, I've had sort of, if you look back at sort of the, you know, again, sort of the, you know, you talked about sort of the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations as being, you know, kind of, you know, last really successful sort of foreign policy presidencies, you know, in America. Certainly the George H.W. Bush administration presidency is recalled as one that was, you know, more willing to, how shall I put this, treat Israel like a normal country than has been the case since. And indeed, sort of one of the takes on, you know, why he didn't, you know, win re-election relates to that in part. I think it's the wrong take, but it is certainly a take I've heard any number of
New Yorkers.
What's that?
People in the New York Jewish community, or
say in one form or another.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, if you look back at kind of what his administration was pushing, right, Israel to do, what he was pushing Israel to do, things that I think most people across the political spectrum now, with the exception of, you know, the sort of the hard, you know, a certain portion of the hardcore would say, well, yeah, no, those would have been good things for Israel to do, right? You know, Israel not too long after that, you know, endeavored to reach, you know, some kind of a settlement with the Palestinians, you know, recognized in principle the need to, you know, withdraw from the bulk of the, you know, the territories in the West Bank and Gaza and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. right? And subsequently came to, you know, under Barak and Sharon's governments, you know, concluded that they're, you know, they embraced the idea of a two-state solution of there being a sovereign Palestinian state, which after Israel embraced it became American policy as well, you know, it's difficult for me to sort of say, well, the reason that, you know, George Bush Sr. was vilified and remains vilified in certain corners is because of the substance that was being pushed, but again, because of sort of that emotional quality to the relationship, namely that, you know, it wasn't a kind of, you know, identification.
Right.
You know, it was, you are us,
it was,
and we
well,
are
right.
You.
It was, fuck the Jews, they don't vote for us anyway.
Right. Well, right. On a domestic political level, but on a foreign policy, right, state to state level, it was, you know, you're another country. We have some interests in common. You know, we have some disagreements, and, you know, this particular aspect of our disagreement is actually really quite serious, and we're going to play hardball over it. Right? Which wouldn't seem weird if we were talking about Japan.
Right.
Right? If somebody sort of talked tough about Japan, nobody would say you're threatening Japanese democracy or, you know, whatever.
Right.
And nobody disputes that Japan's an ally. Right. So what do you think that's about with respect to the, you know, to the American right?
You know, I mean, I think it's a combination of several things. I mean, I think, and here it definitely isn't, you know, isn't just on the American right, right? I mean, the identification with Israel is particularly intense on the American right, but it extends to, at least, I mean, well, it extends to Jewish sections of the American left, but also I think to sort of, you know, certain aspects of certain Democratic voting constituencies. And I mean, I think it's been accentuated by 9/11 and the aftermath. I mean, the sense of having a common enemy in Islamist terrorism, even if, you know, the groups threatening Islamist terrorism don't overlap. I think there's still a sense, you know, I mean, I think the fact that the Second Intifada followed so quickly on 9/11.
It actually started before.
It actually, 9/11, right, sorry, yeah. It started before 9/11, but it reached its peak, as I recall, right, in the winter of 2001, or am I just...
I think the peak was actually, let me think if I can remember the dates. When was Operation Defensive Shield? Was 2003, wasn't it? And the peak, I feel like, was not long before that.
Okay, so it reached its peak sometime after.
But it was, but it started, it was very much
visit
in the news
to the Temple
during,
Mount was in, yeah. Yeah.
Sure, the Temple was before 9/11.
Right. Okay. So it was around 9/11, right? So you had, I think that probably, you know, it, again, not on a necessarily rational level, but on an intuitive level, probably, you know, having the steady drumbeat of suicide attacks going on in a country that Americans already felt very, very attached to in ways they don't necessarily feel attached to Japan, probably played a role in sort of... I mean, I think that's what you see in a lot of sort of right-wing argumentation now, right, is the sense in which, you know, Israel is on the front lines of a war that we are both fighting and so on. And then obviously you have, I mean, I think evangelical identification with Israel was strong in the George H.W. Bush era, but it's even stronger now, for reasons that I don't actually entirely understand. I mean, I understand them on, I have theories about them,
mm-hmm.
Related to sort of, you know, in certain ideas that go all the way back to the American 17th century and sort of American identification with Israel that I think has been picked up by modern evangelicals. And a kind
like
of
quoting from your new book coming.
No, let's not. There are no books. But yeah, so I think all those are some of the things that are going on. I mean, and I think that there's a just sort of a, you know, there's more sort of movement, sort of ongoing movement and connections between America and Israel through the American Jewish community than there are between America and Japan, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in sort of a, you know, I mean...
Yeah, I would, but I would not say that it's more true than sort of the Armenian-American community in Armenia or the sort of, you know, or another, you know, another... I mean, the Japanese community in the United States doesn't have a, you know...
Well, right, okay, but here, well, the Armenians are sort of a somewhat different example, but in the case of the Japanese, I mean, you don't, you know, some of this is just the sense that, going back to the late 60s, of Israel as a country under siege. So a natural identification is heightened by, you know, people don't feel as though...
I actually kind of question that.
Okay.
I question that sort of the identification dates back to the sense of Israel as a nation under siege, because if that were true, it would have been much more pronounced in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and it was much less then. You know, I think
But at that point, Jews hadn't been integrated into American life in anything like the way that they've... I mean, the identification is both that it is a, you know, that Israelis are a people we identify with because we have integrated the Jewish community into our national life in a more profound way than really any other country in the world has, and then there are people under siege.
Maybe. I would add a third element to that. And the third element I would add to it, and I think this is relevant to why I said kind of that it's a place where sort of the Jacksonian and Wilsonian ideas overlap, right? I think to a certain extent, you know, Israel functions as a kind of sort of proxy identity for Americans in that, you know, it's a country that, you know, if you think about sort of what sort of the, you know, that Jacksonian ideal is like, you know, we're
frontier,
yep. Do it ourselves, you know, take no prisoners and, you know, take no guff and, you know, look out for our own type of attitude, you know, and Israel perforce has taken that perspective in their region.
Right, I was looking around for a copy of the Startup Nation, the book that came out earlier this year. I don't see it on my shelf, but anyway,
okay.
Yeah.
I haven't read that one.
Well, it's just, but there was, it's a similar sort of Israel as entrepreneurial Yeah.
Well, what I was thinking about, there was a back and forth between Francis Fukuyama and Charles Krauthammer a few years ago that got rather heated, with Krauthammer accusing Fukuyama effectively of being a sort of quasi-anti-Semite by virtue of some of the things he said about Israel and the American Jewish community. And I'm trying to remember the exact phrase, but Fukuyama talked about sort of American admirers of Israel for its sort of pluck and determination and unwillingness to give ground, sort of absorbing sort of the Israeli preference for, I think as he put it, the testicular route to hearts and minds, right? So in other words, that kind of the identification isn't just kind of, oh, they're Western and we're Western, you know, to the extent that that's true. And it isn't just a, you know, they're a democracy and we're a democracy. And it isn't just, I think, you know, they're under siege and we're under siege, but also, you know, they, you know, profess, you know, in the way they approach the world, what we kind of wish we could profess. You know, we can't because we're sort of big and complicated and have all these interests all over the place. And you know, we sort of gesture towards having that kind of an attitude because it's satisfying, but we can't actually afford it. You know, but they get to live out that. And I think that's a big dimension to what the identification is. And that's why I think it became much more dramatic after 67, because that was Israel's big victory.
Right.
It was not when it was clear they were under siege, but when they broke the siege, that suddenly they became much more interesting, I think, to a different segment of the American population. Where before, I think they really were much more of a parochial.
Now I think that's plausible. Yeah, I buy that. I think that one other factor may be too a kind of identity politics issue where, you know, there is a, I think the. Neoconservative complaint that Israel is singled out for special, you know, special condemnation in the court of world opinion, and that this special condemnation is particularly strong among elements of the hard left. I think that that play. I mean, I think the Zionism is racism. UN resolution, for instance, has a kind of. It's like, you know, oh yeah. I mean, the you know the. There's sort of a common enemy issue, I guess, the sort of, you know, alliance of the radical left and sort of anti-American third world regimes and so on. I mean, it's all sort of a ratchet effect, right? Because first the U.S., first Americans identify with Israel, and then our critics identify us with Israel and attack us both, and then we identify more strongly with Israel and so on. But I think that there is that sort of, you know, the certain precincts of the left, you know, Noam Chomsky attacks Israel. And that makes conservatives more sympathetic to Israel.
Right. I think that's to some extent true. Yeah, I think that's to some extent true.
I mean, and we're also sort of talking around the fact that, you know, Israel is a sympathetic country. I mean, maybe, well, I don't know, maybe. you have much closer connections to Israel than I do. So,
right.
So,
yeah, I have family
but if I may,
so
if I may speak as sort of a representative American who is not evangelical, doesn't have sort of a strong kind of neoconservative front lines of terror, of the war on terror view of Israel exactly, I am nonetheless intensely sympathetic to Israel, sort of just intuitively, and, you know, it has something to do with probably many of the things we've been talking about.
The reasons that America identifies, that Americans identify with Israel in such significant numbers are by and large good ones. Even sort of the problematic psychological reason that I identified of, you know, oh, they get to live out, you know, what we wish we could still do or think we once did, whatever. Even that I don't think is as such a negative thing, right? Because I don't think our frontier past is a negative thing. I think it has negative aspects to it, but I think it also has very strong positive aspects to it. But and the desire to, you know, kind of sort of stand tall and you know, do what needs to be done, you know, regardless of the consequences is, you know, again, even though it has its problematic side, that's not a bad, you know, sort of emotional element. It's only problematic if it's sort of unbalanced by anything else. But I guess there was something I was going to jump off of that you said earlier, and now I've forgotten what it is. Zionism is racism. I think it's absolutely true that Israel gets singled out in a way that lots of other countries don't. And, you know, from one side of the spectrum, you can say, well, that's because of sort of global anti-Semitism and so forth. And from the other side of the spectrum, you could say, well, no, that's actually a tribute to the fact that we consider Israel part of the West, so we hold it to Western standards. We'd be just as tough on France. We wouldn't be as tough on Burma because Burma's not us. Israel's us. And you can go... You know, you can go back and forth, and I think there's some truth sort of to both of those elements. I think it's also true that, you know, what sometimes reads as anti-Semitism is really sort of the region just not sort of, you know, not considering sort of the Jewish story at all of interest or worthy of account. And so from the perspective, I think, of the Arab world in general, Israel is just a colonial intrusion. It's not more complicated than that. You know, and so opposing the very existence of the country, which is somewhat different, I would say, from sort of wanting to kill everybody there. But opposing the very existence of the country strikes people in the region as a totally reasonable thing to believe, you know, just to stand for. And so, you know, regardless of whether the UN created the country, regardless of whether there's, you know, 5 million Jews in the country who have no intention of leaving, regardless of whether there's enormous historical reasons why the country exists that go back well before the Holocaust, you know, none of that's at all of interest, you know, to your average Egyptian, let's say. You know, the story is very simple from his perspective. These people came from somewhere else and they should go back.
I think Thomas theory too. So
yeah, well, she's,
right, and she,
I mean,
right, and she,
she's
and
Lebanese. I mean, it comes from a particular place, right?
Right, it comes from a particular place, but it also has been then, you know, I mean, sort of a lot of the anti-Semitism is imported. I mean, obviously, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion was not forged in Cairo,
but I would say
it's become. It's become understandably difficult, I think, for people who consider themselves pro-Israel to disentangle the completely understandable, if, you know, sort of, this is a colonial intrusion and, you
right.
know, we didn't, you know, Holocaust wasn't our fault attitude from the, this is a colonial intrusion by, you know, crafty Jews, and by the way, the Holocaust...
It's a damn shame he didn't finish the job.
Right. I mean, so and there, I think, I mean, one, you know,
right.
one of the reasons I don't write about Israel that much is, you know, it's sort of I think a Gentile cowardice, or not cowardice exactly, but a feeling that like every possible position in the Israel question has already been taken by an
right.
American Jewish commentator and so on. But I have a lot of sympathy for what. You know, Jeffrey Goldberg tries to do on Israel, and he gets a lot of he particularly gets a lot of flack from it from the left because he is very, very hard on the Walden Mearsheimer school of sort of the interpretation of Israel's role in American politics and so
right.
on, while simultaneously being, you know, critical of the current Israeli government, critical of sort of lockstep, you know, everything that Israel does is fine and needs to be defended attitudes, which I think are way too prevalent on the American right, and sort of conscious of the deep strategic problems that you've written about, I've tried to write about a little, facing Israel
right.
going forward and so on. But I have sympathy, I feel sort of aligned with his view in part because I do think that there is, you know, even though Israel deserves more criticism than it gets, there is a deep sort of, there's a deep rottenness, I feel like, to a lot of the criticism that Israel does get. And mm-hmm. so it's appropriate, I think, to have a kind of two-step where, you know, you're probably, you know, you it's easy to feel like you're being too, you know, too cute or sort of claiming that you're the only person in the correct space on the question and so on. But, like, you know, where you are sort of harsh on both sides, but particularly harsh on anyone who indulges in certain kinds of moral equivalence or relies mm-hmm. on certain rhetorical tropes and so on. But I don't know. What do you
well,
think of Goldberg's
I come at this from a, I come at this from a very different perspective, I guess. So, you know, what I think of Goldberg's writing is I think it's more typical than you realize, and that I think there's a pretty big space out there inhabited by people who identify with the sort of, let's say, the center-left within Israel, you know, wherever the center-left happens to be at this particular point in time, and that has moved over time.
Right.
But who are big defenders of, you know, Israel against what they view as sort of unfair attacks and defenders of sort of the American Jewish community and the pro-Israel activist groups within American public life from what they view as sort of unfair, you know, criticism. I think there's a lot of people who occupy that space, more people who occupy that space actually than kind of the sort of hard right, you know, Krauthammer, Crystal.
Don't you think that space has shrunk to some extent?
I think it's aged. I don't think it's really shrunk. I think
more
the individuals we're talking about have just gotten older, and there's not as much of a younger generation filling that spot.
That's the space that Beinart is sort of trying to occupy, but he is more.
No, he's too,
right, not anymore. I mean, but
that's who Peter Beinart was.
That's what Peter Beinart. Right.
And I think he's a very interesting figure, and what's happened to him is very interesting and honestly really speaks to me, because I think a lot of the road that he's sort of traveled, I've traveled as well and probably gone even slightly further down that same road, which feels a little weird, honestly. What Beinart is grappling with is a real understanding of the pathologies of, you know, Israeli politics and society, particularly Israeli politics. But politics pervades Israeli society in a way that's kind of sort of hard to imagine in some ways. And the ways in which Israel is trapping itself and putting itself in a really untenable position. And historically, that's usually meant sort of talking about sort of missing this or that diplomatic opportunity. But I think what Beinart has honed in on is matters internal to Israel and particularly relations between Israeli Jews and Israeli Arabs,
right,
that aren't really that visible to the outside world. But that are enormous indicators, I think, of sort of what's happening and what's happening to that society in a way that sort of the give and take on the diplomatic front or the degree to which Israel suffers from, you know, terrorism or not in a given year aren't as strong indicators. What's happening is the alienation between the Jewish and Arab sectors in Israel has become much more radical. Israel was never an integrated society. There have always been Arab members of the Knesset, but the Arab parties have never been considered legitimate partners for a coalition government. Arabs have always been able to vote, and they've always been, been citizens, but they have a separate education system, and they have, which is run not by, you know, the Arabs. It's not a sort of separate, autonomous system. It's a system organized by the central government for them, and a variety of other sorts of disparities, particularly with respect to housing and development. Israel has always had a sort of a conscious policy of settling the whole country Jewishly. And all of these are sort of holdover aspects of, you know, when there wasn't really, a state as such, right? The sort of the period under the British Mandate when, there were Jewish institutions and Jewish immigration, and so forth, but there wasn't sort of a state that needed to be responsive, to the entire population, the entire citizenry. And the general feeling, I think, among Israelis has always been that this problem mostly waits until after there's peace, right? That the project of building the state and building the country, ends when we become a normal country and there's, peace everywhere and settled borders and so on and so forth. I've come to the opposite conclusion. And I think Beinart has as well, although I'm not sure. He hasn't sort of declared himself explicitly on that. Israeli Jews and Jewish people outside of Israel, I think, need to grapple with, what it means to be an Arab citizen of Israel and sort of how to answer that question in a way that is plausibly going to work if you were an Arab citizen of Israel, right? Sort of genuinely trying to role play it. But I think that's just as difficult a problem for most Jews to do as it is for most, let's say, Egyptians to really grapple with the existence of the state of Israel, the existence of a predominantly and Jewish identified state in the Middle East that's not going anywhere. Right, and sort of understand it as something that belongs there. I think it's a similar kind of problem. It obviously doesn't have the same dimensions of violence and so forth, but it's starting to have much more significant effects on the way Israelis talk than was the case, 20 or 40 years ago. And I worry a lot about that, and Beinart worries a lot about that.
So what do you think, what is the answer? What does it mean to be an Israeli Arab in a way plausible to?
Yeah, I think it means sort of taking seriously. So the usually this question's posed as a kind of a dichotomy. So either Israel is a Jewish state or Israel is the state of all its citizens, right? So either this is the sort of the character of the state is its Jewish, meaning it is organized around Jewish concerns, right? It's not organized, and everyone else's concerns are sort of secondary. They're others, right? Or, Israel is a state of all its citizens, meaning, it doesn't have any character or something. It doesn't declare itself to be anything, and I don't think that most Western democracies fall into that either or. America arguably is truly a state of all its citizens. The American people is arguably sort of whatever it happens to be at any point in time, simply because of the legacy of being a settler society and the legacy of slavery and mass immigration and so on and so forth.
Right.
But there aren't a lot of other countries on earth that fit that profile. France is a French country while also being, the country of, a state of all its citizens. Germany, and I think Israel needs to start thinking about ways in which it's different from that model and why is it different and whether those reasons why are still operative. On the ground, that the two biggest areas that hits are things like education and the issue of sort of development and housing and things, but it probably ramifies beyond that. I think the big choice that Israel needs to face is whether they want to go down the road of treating the Arabs as a national minority, which would have certain implications in terms of collective rights,
right,
or not. And I think there are pluses and minuses to going either route. Sort of binationalism is usually raised as like a specter, like if we're binational, then there won't be a Jewish state anymore. And I just don't think it's as binary as that. You know, I don't think that again, I don't think it's either or. Oh, if it's you know, if the Arabs have, if the Arab Israelis have, you know, the status of equal citizens, then, you know, you can't have Jewish symbols involved in the government, or you can't have, an established rabbinate or something, or whatever, you know, whatever the, or you can't have the law of return. I don't think that those things follow. Right. And again, I think the right way to approach this is to start thinking, okay, if I were an Arab citizen living in, you know, the Galilee, you know, what would make sense to me? What could you convince me of? You know, is a good place to start in thinking about this. And I think it will also bring into focus more what the stakes are in the territories, because the far right in Israel harbors this delusion that, that the Arab population of the territories can be pacified and can, like, ultimately agree to live in a status that is something less than sort of full citizenship of a sovereign state. And if you start from the proposition that that's not going to happen, and therefore the question is sort of, okay, how do we get from here to there in a way that is...
What do you think, not that you can read such minds, but what do you think Netanyahu sees as...
I think Netanyahu is a terrible chess player. I don't think he has a long-term plan.
Okay. You don't, what do you think that he thinks about the sort of 25 to 40 year problems facing Israel? You don't think that
I have very little respect for Netanyahu, I'll be honest. And that's not because I have no respect for the Israeli right. I think that Sharon was in, I mean, even having moved substantially to the left on a bunch of different things related to Israel, I think Sharon was the right man at the right time, and one of the very few people who could kind of hold the country together and make the country feel like it was in good hands at a time when the country was on the verge of total panic. And I think he managed the relationship with the United States extremely well. I think, and for that matter, I still have sympathy with some aspects of his unilateralism. I understand it. I understand the logic of it.
Right.
And I respect the logic of it. I don't have any similar respect for Netanyahu. I don't think he thinks more than one step ahead on the chessboard. I think he's very constrained by his coalition and is thinking mostly about kind of keeping that coalition together rather than anything else. I think he has delusions about sort of how powerful and independent he is. He flirts sort of continuously with the idea that Israel might do just as well with some other patron like Russia and not relying on the relationship with the United States, which I think is delusional. It's difficult for me to answer the question, what do I think he's thinking, because I don't have a lot of respect for his thought. What I think Lieberman is thinking, and I have a lot of respect for Lieberman, even though I think he's a dangerous person. I think Lieberman is quite smart, and thinks very far down the road. And Lieberman's been pretty explicit about what he thinks the end game is. You know, he thinks the end game is a disengagement that puts Arab Israeli citizens on the other side of a line where they are no longer citizens of Israel, but citizens of a Palestinian state. And then annexes in exchange the biggest chunks of the settlement areas in the West Bank. And I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure that he doesn't think the West Bank will ever be a truly sovereign state in the sense of having its own foreign policy or what have you. I think the notion would be it's a kind of semi-sovereign state that sort of controls its internal affairs, within kind of an Israeli security perimeter permanently. I think that's what he thinks the end game is.
And that is an end game with the virtue of historical plausibility, in the sense that, I mean, one of the things the way these kinds of battles have ended historically is usually with population transfers. And there are all kinds of reasons, both practical and moral, why that probably will not happen in this case.
Right, but, and also it happened already, right? I mean, that happened in 1948, right? So between, you know, what happened in the after the War of Independence, right, is a substantial number of Arabs either fled or were driven out from Israel into what became Egyptian-occupied Gaza and Jordanian-annexed the West Bank. And there was a huge flood of Jewish refugees who were driven out of Arab countries, more after Suez than after 48, but there were some after 48 and a much bigger wave after Suez, from Morocco, from Iraq, from later from Yemen as well, from Egypt, you know, and that was the population transfer, right? To say that the population that stayed put, right, and was granted citizenship and told you're now citizens of Israel, well, now you've got to go also because we can't figure out how to integrate you into the...
To be clear, I agree that it's flagrantly immoral. I'm just saying that there is, you know, I'm saying that you can see where, I mean, as you said yourself, you can sort of, you can see the roots of Lieberman's thinking in the sense that, you know, I mean, you were talking before about binationalism and so on, and, you know, France and Germany and all the, and national identity and all the rest of it. But, you know, I mean, one of the things, and this is a line of Pat Buchanan's that I actually think is pretty plausible, that one of the reasons for sort of the relative stability of post-World War II Europe, in addition, obviously, to the stasis imposed by the Cold War, is the extent to which World War II was a long exercise in ethnic cleansing that, you know, made nation states more ethnically coherent and so on. And, you know, I mean, that is sort of one of the underlying realities in the Arab-Israeli conflict is that there are, one of the things I think that friends of Israel cite in Israel's defense is that there are things that states have done in the past in these situations that are simply off the table for moral reasons.
I think that expelling, I mean, the closest analogy I can think of is still not a good analogy, right? So in terms of recent experience, the closest analogy I can think of is the expulsion of the Serbs from the Krajina region of eastern Croatia, right? So the United States sponsored the Croatian army to basically end the Serbo-Croat part of the Yugoslav wars.
Kosovo actually followed it.
Kosovo was a little bit of a different narrative because this was actually really fairly straightforward. There was a Serbian-dominated region in eastern Croatia. It actually spans from Bosnia to Croatia, and the Krajina region. And you know, the U.S. basically helped the Croatian army drive the Serbs out, you know, and cleanse that part of Croatia. And now Croatia doesn't have a Serb problem. And, you know, I don't feel especially, you know, sort of good about that as a solution. I don't know why anyone should feel especially good sort of about that as a solution. But even that's not a great analogy because, you know, that part of Croatia was in arms against the central government, right? And the Arabs of the Galilee are not in arms en masse against the Israeli government.
Now,
to be fair, what Lieberman's talking about is actually swapping the land as well, right? He's not saying
redraw borders and so on.
And the usual way you play that sort of a game is you say, let's have a plebiscite and decide what country you want to be a part of, right? And that would be great, except that they're not going to vote to join Palestine. They're going to vote to stay as part of Israel. For, you know, economic reasons as well as reasons of personal safety and you know, and so on and so forth. You know, they're not going to vote.
Well, the fact that he's, you know, would be unwilling to have an actual Palestinian state with in the Serbian case, the Serbs could be driven out of Croatia, but Serbia continues to exist as a state, you know, independent of independent of Croatia. But no, look, you have to go back 50 or 60 years to find an example of I think that this is, again, this is part of, I think, the deep underlying fear pushing a Peter Beinart, in some sense, to the left on Israel and sort of narrowing the space you were talking about people who are, critical of Israel but sympathetic at the same time. And so, there is the deep fear that this is where Israel is going towards...
Right,
towards,
I think right, that is
towards
the fear.
Policies that are, all that I'm saying is that you can there's a kind of terrible plausibility to the Lieberman scenario that doesn't seem to exist for, as you said, we don't know what the Netanyahu scenario is. So right now the plausible scenario on the Israeli right is this terrible scenario.
Right. What I guess I want to stress is that I think that these questions about identity and questions about security tend to get conflated. And I think that in the American Jewish community, as well as in Israel, it's really important to keep them separate. After the white paper that forbade further Jewish immigration into Palestine in, what was it, I think, 37, sort of like, well, what are we going to do now? And we have to worry about Hitler, and then now the British are also our enemy. And, Ben-Gurion basically said, we'll fight the white paper, we'll fight Hitler as if there were no white paper, and we'll fight the white paper as if there were no Hitler, And I think that sort of friends of the idea of a Jewish state that's also a genuine democracy need to, take a similar position, we're going to fight, terrorism and fight for, the legitimate security interests of the state of Israel, as if, these identity questions didn't exist, but we're going to, fight to resolve these kinds of identity questions in the right way, as if, the conflict with the Palestinians on the other side of the Green Line and the conflict with the Arab world in general didn't exist, as if
would be then maybe your critique of the Jeffrey Goldberg school that his response to Beinart was, this is fine to say, but you need to simultaneously, when you speak of these internal problems in Israel, you need to speak of them with the threat from Hezbollah, Hamas, and ultimately Iran in mind. And you would say no, that the whole point is that you want to be able to speak of these things separately, in a sense.
Yeah, I think it's important to, because they are separate problems. I mean, they're not completely and totally separate, but they're separable, and it would be, I think, judicious to separate them and would help make progress on both fronts, probably.